That's funny. I turned off my mic and I actually literally cleared my throat after I said we were going to do some throat clearing. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Ryssdal.
Nothing if not an honest man. And I am Molly Wood.
Nobody wants to hear me clear my throat. Welcome to another episode of Make Me Smart, the show where we break down all things in tech, the economy, and culture.
Because, as we like to say, none of us is as smart as all of us, no matter which side of the pond you're on. I have to be honest, all I can think about is my throat right now. Ooh!
Wow.
Look at that signpost.
So you know what's interesting about that? That is, well, yes. I feel like I should stand up and do one of those British salutes. So, we are talking Brexit because I'm getting on a plane on Thursday in like 2 days and going over to London and running around England for a bit to talk about Brexit and why it matters to American audiences and all of that stuff. The very quick primer on Brexit is that going on 3 years ago now, the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union. It was June-ish of 2016. And we are now hard up against the deadline that Prime Minister Theresa May set. And I think it's safe to say nobody knows what's going to happen and what is going on. So it's a mess. It is a mess. It is a mess. It is a mess.
I would even go so far as to say it is a hot mess.
Yes.
But it is also one of those messes that I think still feels fairly abstract to a lot of American audiences, including myself. I still have many questions, not least of which is, what does this have to do with me? And what might this mean for the future of those of us who don't live in either the UK or the EU? So on today's episode, we're going to tackle this beast that is Brexit, why it matters for you. And we're going local to the source. Roz Atkins joins us from London. He is the host of Outside Source at BBC News. Roz, are you still there?
I very much am. Molly, Kai, thank you very much for having me on. I was thinking perhaps we should play Rule Britannia at the beginning of my show each night. I'm not sure if that would work or not. I've not heard that for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
It was just stirring. Yeah. It was stirring.
It was stirring. And, you know, I need to be stirred because the title of your podcast is making me nervous because of all the subjects to talk about and sound smart. Brexit's one of the harder ones.
So maybe what we ought to do, Roz, and I don't want to get all deep into the history here, but y'all, as it were, if you're from the south of England, y'all are trying to undo something. You're undo a union that has been around in one form or another since, like, the common market, right, and the EEC in 1958-ish, right?
So this relationship evolved, you're right, primarily out of the relationships that were built in the aftermath of the Second World War. And by the 1970s, the UK held a referendum about whether to formally commit to a very integrated economic relationship with those countries which were members of the EEC, as it was called at the time. And ever since then, the relationship between these countries has deepened. The name's changed to the European Union. Other countries have joined in. And until 2016, that remained the plan. No one had ever left the European Union. But David Cameron, in his manifesto in 2015, said, look, if I am the prime minister after this general election, I'll give you a vote. He was the prime minister. He gave us a vote. And you know what the result was.
And then he wasn't the prime minister, as that thing.
And then he wasn't the prime minister. No.
Right. One could argue, bad idea, sir.
Well, so interestingly, he and his top advisors, and actually his main spin doctor, to use the phrase we use here in the UK, the kind of communications chief, used to be my boss when I was a radio host at the BBC World Service and was poached by David Cameron from not just being my boss, but the boss of lots of people, to go and be the communications chief. And if you listen to Craig Oliver, my former boss, or David Cameron, or lots of people who argued for that vote, they'll say, look, there was an issue here that had to be resolved. It had been simmering for years. In particular, it had been simmering within the Conservative Party, and that actually, sooner rather than later, this issue had to be addressed head on. Where lots of people disagree with them is that they would say, yes, it had to be looked at head on, but not with a referendum, because they can create huge divisions and huge long-term problems.
I will say the one thing that I feel like I still want to understand is, what were people voting for when they voted to leave the EU? It sounds like you are saying that there was agitation, but What was the goal? What do people want out of leaving the EU?
Well, the beauty, if you look at it one way, or the flaw, if you look at it another way, of a referendum is it asks one question and offers you two simple answers. But actually, the reasons you're voting one way or the other can be multifaceted. And one of the problems that has emerged is that there is no coherence among those who supported Brexit as to the kind of Brexit that they want. And so you have a situation last week in the House of Commons where Theresa May's proposed deal got voted down, not by the people in her party who opposed Brexit in 2016, but by the people in her party who supported Brexit. So you've heard me right there. The people who supported Brexit voted the Brexit deal down. And so this is happening because during the campaign, lots of different people who all wanted Brexit offered lots of different things. So to understand why people voted out, you have to separate things out a little bit. But I would put this as simply as I can, that first of all, there's big concern about immigration among some people, and they didn't like the freedom of movement that comes with the European Union's single market. There was a general distrust of politicians, which you can root back in part to the huge expenses scandals of a few years ago. And this was a chance just to put a V sign up at the political establishment. And last but not least, and stay with me on this, I think it's about the way that globalization is manifesting itself, because people were looking at the mainstream politics, whether this the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, and no one was really offering a fundamental change to the way our economy is structured and the way our economy fits in to the global economy. And they were looking at their experience in their small towns here and there across the UK and thinking, this is no good. The people who are dominating my town aren't the UK government. It's a big multinational from outside the UK. Whichever way I vote, the economic system doesn't change and my life doesn't feel good. And the general elections didn't offer people a chance to get that across, because whichever party they voted for, they still got the same economic system. And so this was a one-off opportunity to put up a huge V sign to the political parties, all of them, and say, we don't agree with your consensus on the economy. We don't agree with your consensus on immigration. And as we can't get a decent choice in the general election, this is our one chance. And here's our message.
Or as we say here in the U.S., President Trump.
Well, yeah, there's that. Is V-sign, yes. Roz, the British way of saying giving him the finger? Is that kind of what you
mean? Yeah, I was wondering that too.
Okay. All right, just check.
So, yeah, I mean, and if you want the detail, and I guess we're making ourselves smart here, yeah, the V-sign in the U.K. is a slightly gentler version of the single-finger saloon.
Okay. All right.
But both mean get lost.
Right. So. Politics aside, which I appreciate is really difficult to do, and the conservatives cannibalizing themselves aside, which I understand is really difficult to do, lay out for the listening audience here what's economically at stake. If this happens on the 29th of March, which is in some doubt right now, and Britain goes crashing out of the EU, which it looks like that will be the solution if it happens on the 29th, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking as you were saying that, presumably, people are going to consume this podcast over the next few weeks, and almost anything we say is hostage to fortune. But you're right. Legally speaking, the UK is scheduled to leave next Friday, March the 29th. In reality, that's quite unlikely, and some type of extension is likely. But putting that to one side, what's at stake economically, if you read the government's own reports, is that any form of Brexit is going to have a medium-term damaging impact on the economy. The government's own reports assess different forms of Brexit. If you looked at soft Brexit, which essentially means reasonably close alignment with the European Union, so you remain in the single market, you remain in the customs union as best as the European Union will allow you, and of course it takes two to tango on that, then the government's assessments are that there will be a hit across 10 or 15 years, but it will not be a substantial hit. If there is what we call a disorderly Brexit or a no-deal Brexit, where essentially the UK just disappears out of the European Union on the 29th with no arrangements in place, well, actually, the assessments are pretty stark. The Bank of England says there could be a drop in house prices versus pre-Brexit of 30%. It also estimates there'll be a significant downturn in the economy. But we should emphasize that none of the government's assessments of any form of Brexit conclude that it will be good for the UK's economy across a 10 to 15 year scale. Can I just add one thing, though, because this is vital. The calculation that voters made was not economic.
Right.
And to understand Brexit, right. you need to understand that. This was about a feeling of wanting control back, of wanting increased sovereignty. This was a feeling of wanting to constrain the level of immigration. This was a feeling about wanting to express the greatness and the independence of the UK. And all of those things are ideological and they are emotional. And that's what drove the Brexit vote, along with all the other issues I've mentioned. It wasn't an economic decision. And actually, Theresa May has acknowledged that as such, and so has the Chancellor of the Exchequer, saying, look, yes, there will be an economic hit in the short, potentially medium term, but people knew that when they were voting, and they were voting for other reasons too.
Hmm. I feel like that we're going to turn now to sort of how, you know, the ripple effects of this. But I feel like mm-hmm. that is something in particular that Americans should keep in mind, because a similar set of sentiment occurred here at the same time during the right. 2016 election. In fact, after the Brexit vote, Americans still made a similar choice, you could argue.
And of course, you know, we won't be the first people to make a comparison between Make America Great Again and Take Back Control. These are both mm-hmm. incredibly potent political slogans which resonated with people, not on a practical or an economic level, but on an emotional level. And one of the lessons that we've really learned from Brexit is that emotion and ideology is potent within politics at the moment. Perhaps it's always been. Because one of the mm-hmm. things I've observed while reporting on Brexit, when I go to Brussels and I speak to journalists and I speak to civil servants and I speak to politicians from the rest of the European Union, when they talk about the EU, they do talk about it in practical terms, but they talk about it in ideological terms and emotional terms. For them, this is an idea of peace and prosperity and cooperation that they care about, and it goes beyond economic calculation. In the UK, even those who were promoting staying in the European Union made practical economic arguments. They said not that the European Union is this incredible idea to which we should embrace and see how further we can push on and integrate. It's something to be tolerated. It's something to be used in order for practical economic benefits. That was the argument on one side versus the emotion and the ideology of let's take back control. This is our Independence Day and phrases like that. And in the end, the emotion quite easily trumped the practical.
Okay, so a word here then about the 27 other parties to this event, because mm-hmm. the rest mm-hmm. of the European Union loses as well.
Well, it does, and it's made no secret of the fact that it would really rather that Brexit isn't happening. The UK economy is sizable. It makes up a decent percentage of the European Union's total economy. And of course, those 27 countries do an awful lot of trade with the UK. So on many, many levels, this is an absolute disaster for the European Union. And it's made no clearer the fact that, you know, I interviewed Jean-Claude Juncker, president of the European Council, 3 or 4 days after Brexit. He didn't try and hide the fact that they were devastated by the result. What's become really interesting, and it's a measure of how toxic politics in Westminster has become, is if you listen to what the politicians in Brussels are saying now, off the record and on the record, there is a palpable desire to get Brexit done because it's becoming such a complicated mess. And the European Union has other big issues like dealing with the migrant crisis, dealing with the euro and so on, that actually they're saying, do you know what? This is becoming so toxic, so complicated that there is a risk of contagion here. We need to say, thank you very much. We respect your decision and we need to get this done.
Talk to us about the ripple effects. Let's say, I mean, even in a soft Brexit, but certainly in a no deal Brexit, the European Union is a huge global economic force. It was created arguably as a force for peace. Like, there are a million reasons to want the EU to remain strong with or without the UK. But what happens? What do these ripple effects start to look like around the globe?
Well, I should first throw in the caveat, which I've been sticking to for the last 3 or 4 years, which I'm done with making predictions after Trump and Brexit and a bunch of other things. So I'll throw those,
Fair.
But frankly, if no deal Brexit occurs, and it's still a big if, but if it were to occur, it's very hard to say precisely what will happen because we'll have never seen anything like it. We'll have never seen an economy of this scale drop out of a union on the scale of the European Union with mm-hmm. absolutely no arrangements in place. And so one of the arguments that remains very potent for the Brexiteers is everyone's warning of all these disasters, but actually they won't happen. They say it's a bit like the Millennium Bug or something that has the potential to be terrible, but actually it might not materialize. So we don't know, but it goes without saying that if you aren't in a single market, then you have to impose tariffs. And so suddenly that trading relationship between the UK and the EU becomes instantly much more complicated, and the way that the UK fits into the global economy becomes much more complicated. But I would say that if you wanted me to pick out the ripple effects I think we would see, they aren't practical ones. They are ones of ideas and they're ones of beliefs. Because actually, what the European Union represents is a form of cooperation that the West has embraced in a range of different ways since the end of the Second World War. And it's largely saying not only has that cooperation failed to be persuasive to the UK, but actually it's failing to function in that they couldn't even come to an arrangement over Brexit. And for me, as I go on air every night on the BBC, the more and more I think about it, fundamentally what this is about are the basic beliefs and systems which we've had in place for Western politics for decades struggling to cope with a new situation. So our two political parties are completely split apart by this. The way our parliament is functioning is in a state of crisis. Even the very existence of the United Kingdom is under pressure because of the nature of Brexit. Mm. The alliances that we've formed over the last decades is also under extreme pressure. And so wherever you look, these things which we assumed were kind of forever, even if the protagonist changed and the ideas and the policies within them changed, suddenly you realize it's not a guarantee this lasts forever. And that, for me, is fundamental. And if no deal Brexit happens, it's a fundamental failure in the way that politics is working in Europe. And if it can fail in Europe, it can fail anywhere. And that's a potent message for people all around the world to consume.
Wow. Okay, wow. So that's where we're
going. Sorry, I didn't mean to be a bit of a downer.
No, that's, you know what? Just, amazing. You know, reality is reality. Roz Atkins, the presenter of Outside Source at BBC, at the BBC. We had him on the line from London. Roz, thank you so much. Roz, that was great.
Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Sheesh. How about that? If he wasn't a guest, I would have said, let's play the Dark Place music. I'm just saying.
I know.
Exactly. I'm just saying. We had a certain producer been on the ball,
there we go.
Man, but that was good. That was.
No, that was fantastic.
Good. I'm gonna listen back to that on my plane ride.
That was really helpful, and I hope you guys agree. Mm-hmm. Because wow. It obviously has been confusing and frustrating. So now we're gonna like come up out of the dark place. You know, it's funny because I always feel that way when you hear about this happened in some other country recently where it was like the government collapsed. Like the government of Finland collapsed today because they couldn't blah blah. And I'm like, wait, what? Or you hear, oh, they dissolved parliament.
Right.
And you think like, wait, what? Right. That idea of permanence, I think about that a lot. That's really, you don't want to follow that thread too far, though.
Man. Permanence takes work. Anyway, so what are we going to do?
It does take work.
Yes.
But there's creative destruction, too. And then it's not always a horrible
outcome. Oh, look at you rolling Schumpeter in here. Oh, man.
And
holy cow. You got a little bit of everything in this podcast. Holy criminies.
Just duck, duck, go that. Let's take a comedy break. This feels like a really good time for a comedy break. It's a comedy break, but also this is like how societies process these things, right? And so here, of course, in the U.S., we've got our Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and Trevor Noah sending up our political chaos. And British comedians are, of course, doing the same. And so we basically picked a selection of the best because not only are they funny, but they sort of get at this idea of like trying to process the reality of this happening all around us. And we're going to start with a Brit here in the U.S., John Oliver's Last Week Tonight.
The eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432.
Wait, what was that noise there? That was the biggest Commons defeat in British history, and they sounded like a middle school lunchroom who just heard someone call to the principal's office. Oh, Theresa's in trouble.
I don't know. I don't know if John Oliver counts as a Brit. He's been here for so long. I'm just saying. I'm just you
fair,
know,
fair
you know,
point. You know, but he has stubbornly clung to that accent. You have to admit,
he has indeed. All right, here's another one. It's a remix. It's called Theresa May's Chronic Brexit.
Theresa May is the name, and it's more of the same. Still pushing to lead, still failing to lead, still not admitting defeat, still dodging questions like their fields of wheat.
That was awesome.
Oh,
I love
wow.
that. I had to put that on.
That is impressive.
Wow, that was cool. I like that one.
That's not.
You got to find it. You got to feel a little bit bad for her, right? I mean, yes, she asked for it, and yes, she's kind of stepped on it a bunch of times, but you still have to feel bad for her.
I mean, what? But right, like, who would do better?
Right,
I challenge
right.
you.
Right, nobody, yes. nobody for sure. Maybe you're wrong.
Nobody.
I don't know.
That right? guy is good.
Right.
Yeah, he really gets it. The metaphors abound, and this was going around Twitter. You may have already seen this make the rounds, but it was so good.
Yeah, it was great.
As a metaphor that we had to bring it into the show. It's from the BBC show called Mock the Week.
The other day, my flatmate was making me a peppermint tea, and he said, would you like the bag leaving in or taken out? And it's very hard, because if you leave the bag in, then over time, the cup of tea itself as a whole will get stronger, and it might appear like the bag is getting weaker, but it's now part of a stronger cup of tea.
Yeah, that one was great. I love that one. That
so
was a very good one.
Smart. Yes. It goes yes. on, too, I think. We should also,
I
feel like
yeah.
I should clarify, when I said this out loud, the show of the name sounded really mean. It's not Mock the Week. It's W-E-E-K. Like the week that that passed.
Yes.
I said it out loud so definitively, yes. too. Like, Mock the Week. And I thought somebody's going to clip that.
Which is not, yeah, no.
It's not what we meant.
No. So look, if you've got a great Brexit metaphor, or frankly, a metaphor for anything, because we're always trolling around for subject matter around here, let us know. Send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Because you guys always have the best ideas. It is time for a quick break, and then it will be time for the things that are on our minds.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen, and if the first time in, I think, 3 weeks, Molly Wood has actually done what she is supposed to do on this podcast, which
Come
is
on.
Tell us what she thought. What? I'm just saying.
I did it last week.
I don't think doing it as I say, we're back, counts as doing it. That's all I'm saying.
It was at least 30 seconds
yes.
before you
well, that's
said
possibly
we're
true.
Back.
That's possibly true.
I know. I don't even know who I am anymore. It's all falling apart.
Yes.
It's all falling apart.
Yes.
I think you should start because that was such a happy... Well, okay, I will start.
Okay, all right, because yours is less happy. So let's start with yours.
It is less happy.
I heard it this morning.
I know, I was really like trying to figure out how to change my tone so dramatically. Yeah. But this is not meant to deliberately be a plug. It just happens to be that the coverage we're doing this week on Marketplace Tech is in the vein of the conversation we are all having now, of course, in the response of the New Zealand shooting, which was unquestionably, apparently, a racially motivated terrorist attack. That also, more than any of the others that we've seen, and we have seen a lot of them that are sort of like tailored to the social media age, this one really, really was. It appears that this shooter was almost the perfect product of online radicalization, that the planning was done, the manifesto was delivered literally in the language of trolls. And then, of course, all of the video. And how these platforms dealt with it. And it's led to a couple of conversations that are really overdue. And I felt like even we're overdue from me and the tech world and our show mm-hmm. about the reality of the extent to which people are being radicalized online and how many people have been saying, you know, the Zainab Tufekci's of the world have been saying, we have been telling you this for years. We have been telling you that there is a playbook for essentially turning a troll into a terrorist. Mm-hmm. And that no, it doesn't mean all trolls are terrorists or will become terrorists, but that there is in fact a ladder that can be climbed and that people who are really, really good at propaganda and manipulation and radicalizing people find it really easy online. And that's like setting aside the whole question of all of the video being uploaded and should it be stopped and how can it be stopped and what is the responsibility of platforms. But so there's a good piece about it in the New York Times from Charlie Warzel about mm-hmm. How we need to be asking big tech, essentially big social media platforms, about the incentives that they provide for not just far right extremists, which is his headline, but for extremism in general. And so we're doing 3 days on this on Marketplace Tech. and looking at the fact that we have systems now that, as we saw in the 2016 election and as we see with like really divisive content, it performs better. Mm-hmm. Like divisive extreme content, whether it's stupid stunts like Logan Paul or really, really extreme like fake news propaganda, it performs really well. And these platforms have an algorithmic incentive and a monetary incentive to keep surfacing this content. And that it's just, it's like an overdue conversation that is starting to happen now. And I don't know if it's going to end up being a turning point, but, and I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to say the platforms have like carte blanche, because it also becomes a conversation about censorship, which Kai and I have argued about many times on the show, right? Like, what is the line?
Well, and so
anyway,
that,
and that's all I'm thinking about.
Yeah. So two things. Yeah. One is, let's put the link to those tech podcasts on our page, because I learned a bunch this morning at whatever the hell time it was, 4:47 in the morning, my time, when I was listening to this thing.
Who learns at 4:47 in the morning?
You can,
I don't
always
even
learn,
understand,
Molly,
that, but
it's
thank
never
you.
Too early to learn. Okay. Just like you're never too old to learn, it's never too early to learn. Get out of bed, learn some things. Anyway, I was stretching. It was time for a bike ride. Anyway. So let's put the link to those podcasts or to that podcast on our page, because it's really, really good. But that whole deal about how we decide to regulate and where the line is in censorship goes right into my item, which is A, unbelievable, B, somewhat related, and C, also just funny as hell. And I'm just going to read it to you. It's a lawsuit filed yesterday by a sitting member of Congress, formerly the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. His name is Devin G. Nunes from California. And I'm going to read it to you. It says, complaint. Plaintiff Devin G. Nunes, by counsel, files the following complaint against defendants, Twitter Incorporated, Liz Mayer, Devin Nunes's mom, at Devin Nunes's mom is the Twitter handle, and at Devin Cow is the Twitter handle, jointly and severally. And here's the first line of the second paragraph. Plaintiff seeks A, compensatory damages and punitive damages in an amount not less than $250 million. Now, if Ken White's listening to this, which I hope he is, he's at Popat, and we've had him on the program, and he's a big First Amendment guy, he will tell you that this is a stupid lawsuit. I would also say it's really revealing, because here you have a sitting member of Congress suing Twitter and a comedian and a political strategist about making fun of him on Twitter. And number one, snowflake, but number two, really?
Yeah.
$250 wow. million. Dollars.
I mean, he asks for court costs related to, quote, insulting words.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And this is a public figure. I mean, the First Amendment response to this alone is, can I think, be effectively summed up as, okay. But
yeah, it's amazing.
Also,
Yeah.
Twitter had a pretty fun time with this yesterday, as you might imagine.
Yeah. So,
and I, for one, didn't even know about Devin Nunes's mom or Devin Nunes's cow. And now I do. So Streisand effect.
Right. Exactly. So we should say Liz Mayer runs these two accounts, Devin Nunes's cow and Devin Nunes's mom, and uses it to make fun of Devin Nunes, who was, if you follow the news, was very protective of the White House and President Trump during Congressman Nunes's stint as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee for the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And I just think it's really, really interesting. So read this lawsuit and learn some things. And we'll put a link to it on our page.
We definitely will, because one of the things that you should know is that one of the things it alleges about Twitter is that Twitter uses, quote, explicit censorship of viewpoints with which it disagrees. It, the entity that is Twitter. So this is a huge part of this idea that there's an anti-conservative bias on social media. I mean, the entire conversation, and you're absolutely, like, these two things are sort of accidentally super related, the entire conversation about speech and platforms and free, and this is why, frankly, these platforms don't want to get into the business of moderating
speech at a high level. Look, it's completely perilous. It's completely perilous, but somebody's got to step up and help figure this out, because otherwise, to bring it full circle in a really tragic kind of way, you get New Zealand.
Yeah. Right? Well, yes.
I mean, you know, in a tragic and extremely roundabout kind of way, but it's, you know, they're not unrelated.
Oh, no, you definitely do. They're not unrelated. We talked to an expert for tomorrow's show Wednesday.
Don't give it away.
God, I don't even know what day it is. Anyway, it is faster and easier to radicalize people online. And if we don't take it seriously and disrupt those loops, then yes, that is an inevitable and horrific outcome.
And here.
Okay, let's let you guys talk for a minute.
Let's.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right. So, last week we did not, because we were jammed up for one reason or another, we didn't get to everybody's quantum computing questions and thoughts. A couple of them today. Joe Strins sent us this voice memo about Chinese competition in the quantum computing race, which we talked about a lot, actually, on that episode.
Mm-hmm. I keep hearing that the Chinese government is subsidizing all of its industries. Where is it getting the money to do this subsidizing? How can it keep doing this without running out of money?
I love this
question.
Wow.
So look, we should actually do an episode on modern monetary theory. That was kind of a joke, but not really. They control their own currency, the Chinese do. And it's a command economy with capitalist characteristics. So they can do whatever they want with their money. Print more of it. You know, yes, there's inflation, but they could tax and take it out and this and that. They got money. So look, our $800 billion trade deficit and the chunk of it that belongs to the Chinese, we send American dollars over there to buy stuff at Walmart, and that's where they get money.
But also, what I love about this question is that it reminds me of the tale of how, like, Enron was unraveled by one Fortune reporter who said, "How do you make money?" I feel like there's a part of that that could be a part of this too. Like, everybody thought the Soviet Union had money too. Turns out they didn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I love that. And I think we should totally. I just want to do an episode on the Chinese economy because command economy, like, that's super interesting. All that. I love it. Hey, so in the interim, since we did that episode and today, I met a quantum computer. I got to go visit one.
Did it say hello? Did you shake hands?
No, I don't understand. It didn't say hello.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I got to go see, be in the same room and see how it works and, like, hang out with a liquid nitrogen.
So I saw your Insta, or whatever it was, and it was a bunch of pipes and tubes.
I only got to take pictures of the pipes and tubes.
Really?
Not the actual
There's more to it that they wouldn't let you take pictures of? Because what? It's like...
Well, actually, in retrospect, I probably could have taken... So the quantum computers, the one I've... So I went to Microsoft, and the one they have, it, like, lives inside this white tube. And inside the white tube is the actual architecture of the quantum computer that is being kept at, you know, 100 times colder than deep space.
Right.
And I probably could have taken a picture of the white tube, but I was a little unclear. And then I was also asking questions at the same time and doing an interview, so I just panicked.
Fair enough.
I didn't do it, but it was pretty awesome. And it was super interesting because I learned a whole bunch about this next question, which where Steve Weber talked about the power that it will take for quantum computers to self-correct. Listener David Hart from Dallas left us this voice memo on that.
His comment about the errors introduced into the quantum computer and the amount of computing power that may be necessary to correct those errors makes me wonder whether the quantum computer would self-assess or whether a second quantum computer would provide the check on the first.
That's kind of what I've been saying the whole time. It's like Katie barred the door with these things.
I know, but now I know the answer.
Oh, and?
Like, I actually learned the answer. So part of, okay, so the way they work is that the actual little processing unit of a quantum computer is called a qubit. And I'm not getting into the physics of how that works,
that's,
but it's
like
essentially some
qubit,
entangled...
Right? That's Noah's Ark stuff, qubit.
Oh, yeah, but this is with a Q. Different. Different qubit. But kinda. That's somebody please do that paper for us, like how a qubit is like a qubit from the Bible.
Right.
Don't do that. So the qubit is the little processing unit, essentially, and it is, you know, constructed by these, like, entangled particles that go to superposition and they process. And you want your qubits to be really stable because the more qubits, because errors get introduced when they're not, and that's why they have to be kept in the super cold environment to keep out any noise. So if you can create very stable qubits, then you need fewer qubits in the actual quantum computer to correct the errors. So basically you've got one that's working, and like anywhere from 200 to 200,000 qubits around it are almost like... are trying to correct the errors in the one that's working. And I don't know if they actually disentangle. Like, in my mind, they became like kamikaze qubits. Like, they all sacrifice themselves
to keep the one going.
Yeah.
Molly.
Yeah.
You lost
me. Am I geeking out?
You lost me a little bit. I'm a little lost.
It'd be like if you, Kai, were on live television and you were... And you were giving tons of, you were trying to explain for the 1,000,000th time to Molly Wood how bonds work.
Okay.
And you were fallen apart a little bit because you had taken a red eye.
Okay.
And so depending on how much sleep you'd had, somewhere between 1 and 50 people in the control room behind you would be feeding you accurate information to keep correcting.
Oh, okay. All right.
When you fell apart.
I'm with you. Okay. Okay.
Right.
All right.
And so
there you go.
Depending on your level of stability in front of live television.
Gotcha.
That's how you determine how many people behind you will be needed to correct you.
Look at that.
Yeah. So whoever can get this technology right the soonest will be able to construct these computers with the lowest possible amount, number of qubits, and that will make them cheaper, easier to produce, and faster to market.
Got it. Excellent.
Boom!
Yes, that was awesome. You should stop right there,
Quantum
but that
crap.
Was awesome. That was
I'm done.
That was really good. Okay. All right. Good, good. Yeah. Okay. So
next. Okay. What
moving
else
on.
We got?
A couple of weeks ago, we talked about taxes and how people feel about taxes and how people in this country feel about taxes, given the fact that most Americans want the government to do more for them, but not necessarily want to pay for it. Mike Rothman sent us his voice memo.
Count me as at least one person who would be willing to pay more in taxes in order to have the government provide us with a stronger social safety net and a more equal society.
I think that's probably true.
Right.
I think if you could get the politics out of this, which I understand is a non sequitur, I think that's what people would say.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
I mean, I think you would argue that was that again, and I don't know why I always keep coming back to this, but this wasn't that the entire premise of the original Democratic Party? Like, yes, there will be more taxes and you will get a stronger social safety net and more equal society. I mean, I'm not saying they implemented that perfectly. I'm just saying that paying more taxes has always been like part of the deal of at least one party.
Yes.
All right. It is time for the Make Me Smart question. And I'm so excited about this.
Did you meet her,
because
by the way? Did you meet this person you're about to talk about? Oh, okay.
I didn't. Well, and I just love, I basically just Twitter stalk her and I'm obsessed with her. She's like amazing and hilarious and changing the world one tweet at a time. Jameela Jamil is an actress on the NBC show The Good Place. She plays, dang it, come on, you know. She plays Tahani. Tahani!
Yes, yes.
Thank you. Well, if you knew that all along, help a girl out. Come on.
Because I saw the producer through the glass doing her job, whispering in your ear.
All right. See, she was like a qubit.
I didn't want to be one of those qubits. I was just going to say, I didn't want to be one of those qubits. I didn't want to be two qubits. There was only one qubit feeding you information.
I needed two, maybe three. Anyway, she answered the Make Me Smart question, which is, of course, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Shara Morris and Eve Tro caught up with her at this year's Makers Conference, and here's what she said.
One of the things that I thought I knew that I now realize that I was wrong about is that I thought that I was a fully formed feminist, and I was wrong, and I had no idea that we are all feminists in progress, which is a term I use for myself because I believe we never stop learning and there is never too much information that you can have, and it's so important to learn more and more and more about being as intersectional and as tolerant and as much of an ally as you can be. I may never be doing fully enough, but that doesn't mean that I shouldn't keep trying.
Well, there you go. That's pretty motivating.
I love her. By the way, that is essentially that's basically the content of her pinned tweet, which is what she posted on December 15th. Yeah. And I am convinced that it was inspired by Shara and Eve asking her that question. That's my theory. I don't know for sure.
Look, let's claim it, even if it
cross-referenced the dates. But yeah, I'm owning that.
Yeah. So the Make Me Smart question one more time. What is something you thought you knew but found out you were wrong about? Record a voice memo on your phone. Send it to us. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. And we'll get you on the podcast.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Oh, God. You know what we didn't do?
What?
We didn't do end of the.
Oh, we're going to at the end.
Are we? Oh, look at me scrolling down now.
It's not the end yet.
The producers are going to do it. Well, if only certain producers would include in a certain host.
Oh, Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. They are busy under the bus right now. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks this week to Jody Becker. And this week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. This theme music right here that you're listening to was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Oh, God, we're starting to rock out. Go!
We got plenty of time. Executive Director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Senior Vice President, General Manager Deborah Clark doesn't listen to the end, as we know, but there are some people who do, and it's a club.
It's a club now. It's the end of the pod club. John Brookhouse.
End of the pod club. John
this
Brookhouse.
This is for you. Surprise!
If we can be expeditious about this, yes. Let's hope the first one is for you, because... All right, we ready?
Expialidocious. Yes.
Here we go.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.